100 years or so from now, I believe, a famous novelist will write a classic using that theme. He'll recommend those three words even over I love you.
Centuries from now. Who is he? Where does he come from? Where will he come from?
Silly question. Want to hear a silly answer?
Yes.
A planet circling that far left star in Orion's belt. See?
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am the host, Terry DeFellin, and I am joined by my two friends, Derek Mantle.
Hello.
And Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And we are going to be discussing the classic original series episode, The City on the Edge of Forever. Almost forgotten the name of it.
did you almost forget to put the at the beginning of it?
Yeah, it is the City on the Edge of Forever, isn't it? It's not City on the Edge of Forever.
No,
yeah.
It's often referred to as City on the Edge of Forever, but when it comes up on the screen at the beginning, it is that big the.
Maybe that's a Roddenberry rewrite.
Maybe it is. But
In fairness, we are looking at the comic adaptation of Ellison's original teleplay, and it is The City on the Edge of Forever. So that's one thing that Harlan Ellison can't complain about this episode. We're going to focus on the episode, the aired episode, in this edition of Whom Pods Destroy. In the next edition, we will be talking about Ellison's teleplay and the fun and at times quite amusing narratives surrounding it. But let's start with that. I'm sure if you're a Star Trek fan listening to this episode, you will know The City on the Edge of Forever. It is easily the most popular and most well-loved of the original series, and probably amongst many fans of all of the series, although I'm sure there are others to rival it. I'll start with that, actually. You guys have seen probably almost all the Star Trek. I'm figuring there might be some episodes of Enterprise, DS9 that you might have, you know.
There's quite a lot of Enterprise I haven't seen.
I concur.
But so, I mean, from your own personal recollections there, I mean, how highly does The City on the Edge of Forever rank?
Yeah, very high.
Yeah,
yeah. It's well, I was going to say that sort of like it's. For me, it was like the first proper introduction to a sort of hardcore science fiction idea.
Mm.
It really does shine out there at the time.
Yeah, it strikes me, Graham, as being a very grown-up episode.
It tackles a difficult, not difficult subject, but a morally questionable subject. Mm. And attacks it, which is in a really
What's
good
the morally way. Questionable subject? Well,
the fact of letting someone die, so that a greater good can happen.
Mm.
It's the first time I think we see in Star Trek that what they come back to in the films is the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed.
So this is but this is the first example of it. I think we really see it,
yes.
And it's done in a very, very powerful way.
Yes. That's interesting that needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And because it's Spock who says that in Wrath of Khan, is the first time we hear that. And it's Kirk that adds, or the one, in that conversation, isn't it? I wonder whether or not Kirk is thinking of Edith Keeler in that.
Maybe.
Because the legacy of The City on the Edge of Forever is Kirk's relationship with Edith Keeler. And that I think that, not canonically, but I think, if you like, in side canon, Edith Keeler is one of the great tragedies of Kirk's life story. David A. Goodman wrote a fictional autobiography of James Kirk. And it's a faux, it's an authentic autobiography, if you take my meaning. And there's some, you know, sort of like publisher's notes at the end of it. And at the end of that, he says, you know, after Kirk's death, you know, they were going through his effects and they found this little box. And in it, there's a few tokens, including some passport photos, and they show them as a mock-up of and their publicity stills of Kirk and Joan Collins, of Shatner and Joan Collins. And these were found amongst Kirk's personal effects, sort of like, you know, and sort of a... you know, a treasured memories, or of perhaps of a life not led. And I suppose that's the other thing about City on the Edge of Forever, isn't it? It also opens up the possibilities of lives that we don't get to lead.
True. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a cracking episode anyway. But the idea about the time paradox that is in this, which is brilliant. You know, the idea that sort of the whole of history will be changed just because of one person's life and how they, you know.
Yeah.
So supposedly in this episode, she seems at the beginning there was just like a normal everyday person.
Yeah.
And then out from her existence and her influence, the whole world will change if she stays alive, which
yeah.
is just it's a brilliant sort of idea that sort of Harlan Ellison came up with. And it's been used so many times. We've seen it. In fact, Harlan Ellison's used it quite a lot himself.
Well, it's used in Star Trek as well earlier. Tomorrow is Yesterday, Captain John Christopher has to be returned to his proper place in time because otherwise his boy won't get born and his boy won't go to Mars or something like that. The course of Earth history will be altered. So it's not something that hasn't been done in Star Trek. And that's a mid-first season episode.
Yeah,
it's the one where you get to see the Enterprise flying through the Earth upper atmosphere.
Yeah. Well, it's the whole H.G. Wells butterfly effect, isn't it? That's what it all comes back to, isn't it? It's that. It's a common trope in sci-fi. It's actually a genre in itself, isn't it? It's looking at it, and once you get over the paradoxes, or once you embrace them,
yes,
then you can have a lot of fun, and you mm-hmm. can ask quite strong moral questions.
Yeah.
And really, so you can look on City on Fredger Forever as a precursor to something like Terminator.
Well, yeah. Harlan Ellison is supposedly
another influence on that.
Well, his story Soldier, which was an Outer Limits episode.
Yes, and that won a Screenwriters Guild Award as well.
Oh, did it?
Yeah,
okay.
I think it did.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You see, so Ellison he has fingers everywhere.
He submitted that one himself as well. So, I think as well is that this is also very reminiscent of the most popular film, Star Trek IV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the best one as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we've established
on this podcast.
Empirically.
the whole relationship between Kirk and the 20th century woman in both episodes is very, very similar. There's lots of things. And of course, Ellison was brought in to help on the with the story for
Star Trek 4. Yeah.
And there are elements in Star Trek 4 of City on the Verge of Forever. And it's only watching both of them quite close together recently that you pick up on them. Like as soon as they arrive in the city, Kirk's almost run over by a van.
Mm.
Yeah, almost exactly the same way as when he lands in San Francisco.
Double dumbass on you thing. No, absolutely. I hadn't put that together. But of course, you're quite right. Yeah, it is. Again, that's a little bit of a trope as well, isn't it? Fish out of water, walks in front of cars.
No, exactly. But
walks into traffic, not knowing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and as well, the whole fish out of water thing allows you to have a little bit of comedy in what would otherwise be a very, very serious episode.
Yeah.
And I know there's something that the comedy can be a bit misplaced, a bit quirky in terms, but it's not in any other part of the episode. So it's quite nice to have it sort of quite lightened up a bit and sort of like early in the second act.
And
so you can just get on with the more sort of serious thing of you're actually in the Depression, you know, Nazis are about to take over the world, everyone's dead.
So I mean, let's get into the nuts and bolts of things a little bit. I mean, this is DeForest Kelly's favourite episode, and we can see why, can't we? Because he puts in a very memorable performance. There are some serious scenery chewing going on at times.
Yeah,
the whole quadracene incident, where you know a fully qualified, experienced medical professional decides to use an incredibly deadly drug in the middle of an emergency on the bridge. And hilarity ensues.
He does only have a very small pouch, and he obviously picked up the dangerous drugs pouch by mistake. I mean, well, I'm on the bridge now. Better risk a couple of drops of this.
I mean, he's sort of like, you especially brought that stuff with you?
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't bring, maybe could you have not brought, obviously we couldn't have moved forward with the story without that, but you know, you, I mean, you can see why critics of the program, of the show, and the show does have its critics.
Yeah.
Maybe one. But it is an important critic who say whether that is a bit of a foolish premise with which to proceed.
Yes.
Agree or disagree?
Yeah, no, I don't. I actually quite like it. And I like it in the respect that it does bring a regular character into it, but allows him to act out of character.
Yes.
For a short period of time and with no long-term repercussions because of it. And I think it's... And that's quite good. Yes, you could say, as Ellison himself would say, he didn't like that whole scene. But then again, a lot of what he was writing was the fact that time was drawing all these events together. So these things were going to happen anyway. So you could argue, well, you know, no matter how ridiculous these things seem, they were meant to happen, and so they will, things will find a way of...
Yeah.
It's a good cop out, anyway.
It is a bit of a. Yeah, I mean, McCoy does. The script foreshadows by saying, I'm going to risk a few drops of cordyceine. Kirk goes, that's heady stuff, are you sure? And,
And the thing is with the going to the actual script, is that with Harlan Ellison, and as you said, having displeasure about what they did to actually bring McCoy into it. I think it works brilliantly because it's like it's quite quick. You know,
gets you to the action really, really quickly.
Yeah. And you know, and the point you made about also, it gets to the action very quick. Also, the lightness as well later on that we have is obviously it's part of Star Trek that they've put in. There is lots of I actually like the changes that happen to this episode.
Do you?
Not obviously all of them, but the thing is that. I think that someone like with Harlan Ellison, who is quite very much an intellectual author, and sort of some of his ideas, he really he chisels away and refines these ideas sometimes a bit too much, and that he creates something that's probably that isn't necessarily fits into the slot of where Star Trek is at the time compared to all of the other show stories around.
We'll reflect on this in the next edition. Definitely.
But it is,
because I think that's a really interesting point that you've made.
Yeah, but you can see that actually the City on the Edge of Forever is definitely one of the best produced, and you know it hits all of the targets.
Yeah.
As a really good piece of entertainment for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Well, they do. You know. They do. Throw everything at it.
Yeah.
I mean, this one cost, I think, $60,000 more than any other episode.
Yeah, and at the time, that was a lot of money.
Considering that each episode was under $200,000 that they made, this one was right at the end of season, so maybe they felt, well, we really have to go for it to get the series renewed, and there was a danger that they weren't going to get renewed.
Yeah.
So they paid big on the guest star. They paid big on the sets, they got in the star writer of the time and someone who was exceptionally well connected.
Indeed, as people who listened to our last edition of Film Boss Destroy will appreciate, because we discussed the new wave of science fiction of which Ellison was very much a central figure.
So this was always going to be picked up with interest by TV companies, and you know, once those publicity stills came out, they would have been everywhere, wouldn't they?
Mm.
So it was certainly something that he could probably, the producers probably could gamble a bit of extra money, and it shows.
Yeah,
I mean, we've discussed episodes on this podcast before where they've had episodes where you've seen they've gone big in one area and they cut it back everywhere else.
Yeah.
James Babel was a great example of that, where they've gone for costumes and they've gone for guest stars.
Yeah,
and everything else there is all a bit shonky. It's all a bit clunky, and the script.
Well, the script isn't very good.
No, exactly.
Deep down, I mean, it's a spectacular episode, but it's the script is not very good.
Yeah.
The script in this episode is superb.
Yeah,
it is superb. And, I mean, and wherever you fall upon you can still feel that this is a bastardized version of Ellison's original teleplay, and still acknowledge.
yeah.
that it's a good script. I think you can be both.
I know we're going to talk about this in the next pod, but I mean, for me, this works perfectly, and it works a lot better than the original one would have done. There are reasons why.
We'll discuss that.
Yeah.
You might encounter an alternative point of view there. But let's discuss that at another time. Let's stick to this episode in particular. Yeah. Okay.
Could we go back to the actual characters in this?
Yes, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Because we want to go through all the characters. But the first character that took my notice was when I was a kid was actually the Guardian itself.
Because
that, for me, is a character.
Yeah.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space, and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
And at the time, I hadn't seen anything like that. And also the idea about creating something which is a machine, but also organic. That's the first time I came across that idea as well, biomechanical stuff, which is obviously it's a big trope in science fiction now.
Yeah.
And also reality now.
Not so much then.
And obviously this you know, piece of rock which pulsated, you know, sort of psychedelic colours and stuff like this at the time was actually quite stunning to see, you know. Not the original time, because I wasn't around the first time round, honestly. I wasn't born.
Actually, he might have been.
I might have been. Because that's because I went back in time.
Remastered versus original version, Graham. I assume you only watched the.
You watched the original version.
Yeah.
Yes.
The colours of. There's been an extra bit of colour added to the Guardian.
There's quite a bit of colour on it anyway.
I have to say that I think that, again, this is a situation where they would have been better off sticking with the original. A measure of how many times I've seen this episode, at the end of the episode, when the credits are rolling, before they go to the end credits, where you've got, you know, written by, music by, blah, 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 blah. Every time the caption comes up, a text comes up, the picture freezes in the background because of 60s television.
Yeah.
And of course the smoke coming out, emanating from the Guardian, also freezes.
Right.
And this is something that I had noticed when I was a teenager, having watched it for the umpteenth time. And it's one of those things you can't unsee whenever you see it. And of course I sat and watched the remastered version yesterday for only the second time. And I remembered this. And they've corrected it in the remastered version. And I don't know how I feel about that. it's a good
thing. Do you know what? I think you're not sure how you feel about it because you're not sure that you should feel something about it.
I think there's something cathartic and it's a bit of a tonic talking about these things and saying these things into a microphone and saying these things out loud for other people to hear. Because I'm certain that there are other people who equally, when you take on a passion, you develop a bit of a schoolboy obsession about things.
I bet there's a 12-page thread on some Star Trek forum that's all about this.
Yeah, and there is, and I sincerely hope that there is, because I know we've made a slight contribution there. But getting back to the more serious.
Well, getting back to the schoolboy obsessions. Let's go back to the characters again, because we haven't spoken much about the guest star.
No, we haven't.
You know, Joan Collins.
Joan Collins.
It being the Joan Collins episode.
Yes, it is the Joan Collins episode. Yeah. As you, Graham, it's not the Harlan. For most people, this isn't the Harlan Ellison episode.
No,
is it? It's the Joan Collins episode.
Yeah. This is the sort of conversation you have with people who aren't into Star Trek.
Yeah.
They will remember this episode.
They go, that's the one with Joan Collins in it. Yeah. Or even that's the one with...
I remember the one with Joan Collins in it.
Her off Dynasty.
Yeah.
If they really... Joan Collins is a household name.
Yeah.
And wasn't a household name then. I mean, I think she kind of remembers it was that she was a working actress.
Yeah.
And she, I think, I listened to Joan Collins at the Vegas last year. And she was a jobbing actress. She was working.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was perhaps being a little bit more humble about her situation at the time, because I think she was quite well known, but she certainly wasn't by any stretch successful. And
she was doing okay on the networks because she was doing The Man from U.N.C.L.E. She appeared in there and the usual in Mission Impossible.
Yeah, she was getting robust guest star gigs.
I think her husband was perhaps more famous at the time, Tony Newley. And I think his style was falling while her style was rising.
Beginning to rise, yeah. And it's interesting because, I mean, they had a young family as well. So they had all of that going on there. So there wouldn't have been a great deal of money coming in. So the impression that I got from her was that she was a hardworking actress and has continued to be so throughout her career, it should be said. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, in many ways, this episode rises or falls on the character of Edith Keeler and how well it's portrayed by Joan Collins. When I first saw this episode, Joan Collins, this was around Joan Collins' The Stud and the Bitch era.
Well, that's the thing, we were
before Dynasty.
Yeah.
So when we were at school, and obviously if you're a heterosexual young teenager, you were in the 1970s and 80s, you'll have known who Joan Collins was because of The Stud and the Bitch.
Did you actually see those
racy
films?
No,
at the time.
I didn't. No. I mean,
did you see those at that time?
I did. I saw.
Oh, you would do, wouldn't you? I didn't see any of them. I mean, we heard everything about these films.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously the posters were quite sort of risque.
The halfway between Confessions movies and 50 Shades, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah.
On the classometer, aren't they? Yeah. Racy, very sexually charged dramas for adults in which, we get to see Joan Collins' lady bits. And that's the kind of the backdrop that so when you see her in this far more traditional dramatic role and, a bit younger as well, I was surprised. I must confess, I don't think I had a tremendously high opinion of her abilities as an actress.
So you dropped your biscuit.
And I was a bit surprised to see her there. And I was delighted with her performance. I think she dominates the screen.
Well, she was a child actress as well, wasn't she? I mean, she...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think she had appeared in some earlier things. Or I'm actually probably getting a bit confused.
I must admit, when I first saw this episode, I pretty much knew her as the Cinzano woman.
Oh, with Leonard Rossiter. Right. Yes, I think we all. Yeah, of course
was
we all
did. Was it?
Yes. Oh yeah, yeah. Yes, her and Leonard Rossiter, and she's amazing in those. Yeah. If you look back on them now,
stick them on the website.
You do that because the one on the plane is unbelievable. It's all done in one shot, all one from one camera angle, and it's got these glasses coming to and fro, and you know that the payoff is coming at any moment. But it is the timing in it is just unbelievable. Mm. Just for a 30-second spot, it's like it is a brilliant advert. And Leonard Rossiter's brilliant.
Leonard Rossiter is brilliant.
And she is like, she's like going toe to toe with him. And like, yeah. So it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, one thing wonderful. That, yeah, I mean, I think that the point I think I'm developing is that you it's a lesson in not underestimating or understating the talents of good professionals. Even if they happen to be cast into characters that you might perhaps think less of or feel are unworthy. She knows her craft, and I mean, you don't get to last as be a woman and last as long in this business without being a very, very good professional.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what it is. So let's return to the story then. The crux of the story is. They've gone back in time to stop McCoy from altering the future. They've come before McCoy has arrived to make him stop. They're not entirely certain what needs to happen, and for a while the story hinges on, they know it's that Edith Keeler has got something to do with it, and in the meantime Kirk is falling in love with Edith Keeler, and they don't know whether or not to save her or whether or not she has to die. And this is in these moments when the romance between the two blossoms. I think one of my favourite scenes in that is when he's walking her home, and the goodnight sweetheart scene in which let me help line.
And
I mean the maturity of the dialogue in between those two characters, and it has to be said the acting performances of both actors.
Yeah.
I mean, as I said, this is proper grown-up drama. It's a romance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it actually transports you away from Star Trek for a while. It's still Star Trek, but everyone's dressed differently. It's in an entirely different environment. And you've got two mature people falling in love, and I think it's a lovely scene, and it goes off nicely with the establishment shot of the Hudson Bridge and Goodnight Sweetheart going along. And you could be watching anything, couldn't you?
The timing of this episode is very well done, considering that, you know, it's three quarters of an hour. You've got to establish characters, you've got to establish the relationship, because that's pivotal in here, and all the while you've got the story arcing away behind there of the fact that McCoy's going to come soon and he's going to ruin everything.
That's the thing. There is a lot of suspense there. You are actually waiting for it. You think, when is it going to happen? Yeah. You know it's going to happen, but you don't know what the hell is going to happen.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
You know.
And there are bits of dialogue that nowadays seem clunky. One of the really shocking bits when the Enterprise disappears. They lose contact with the Enterprise, which is great, and it's the instant impact of the change in time. But you know, you got Uhura saying, "I'm frightened," and he's like, which got a modern ears, it just sounds a bit.
That's garbage. That is, yeah. But I mean, you have to contemporize, man. Yeah, it is clunky. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But they get through ideas really quickly, and it gets you used to where the story is and why it's important.
Yeah, and you could so easily because it does blind, it wows you with its visuals.
Yeah.
And then that also then helps you to acclimatise to the changing visuals of the show, because it's such a different show to all the other ones that have gone beyond there, because it's not set in space, it's not set on a spaceship, it's not set on another planet. It's set in an environment to which, even if you are watching it 50 years later in another country, it's one that is very, very familiar to you and to us. And you can't always sell that easily. Mm. You could get that wrong.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what my blistering take is for this episode?
Yes, I do. Well, I mean, if you have one, we should know what it is.
They don't go back in time at all.
What?
Yeah, it's just basically another version of Talos IV they've gone to, and he ends up just going around and just playing out a scenario that's meant to be in 1930.
Yeah, they're not quite
really?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, why? Yeah. I'm assuming
it's an exterior shot.
We need you to show your work here.
Okay. Yeah. Well, they've gone back to 1930, yeah?
Yeah.
Goodnight Sweetheart doesn't come out until 1931. In one of the exterior shots, there's a nuclear fallout shelter.
Is there?
Yep. In one of the establishment shots outside, they show a street with people walking down, and there's a sign for a nuclear fallout shelter.
Okay, I feel a lot better about my smoke coming out of that thing. I feel a lot better about that now. Okay, I mean, fine. Goodnight, Sweetheart. Yes, all right. You're carrying me there. The nuclear fallout shelter. That's got to be just a mistake, right?
Yeah. No, of course it is. But the thing is, like, there's no proof that they've gone back in time. All that happens is that they just lose contact with the Enterprise.
That's true.
You know, you could easily write that in and say, you know, the on Talos IV they made people believe that they were anywhere.
Yeah,
in any time.
Those two continuity errors that you've took, which I would put down as technical problems. But you could actually make that argument about every single episode of Star Trek ever made. So the whole thing.
That's what all my blistering takes are about.
Yeah. It's that whole Buffy in the mental hospital thing, isn't it?
Which we
never know, actually, from that point. We never know whether the whole thing is going on in Buffy's. And the point is, it doesn't matter because it's fiction.
Of course it does. You say
it's all happening in everyone's head.
Yes. And of course, they could all be in a mental hospital somewhere. Like
yes, we could all be. That could be. And you, listener. Yeah, you couldn't. You might not be sitting on the train right now.
After listening to this, you probably are, or taking extreme medication.
We'll reflect upon Koi's arrival and his performance, because you've also got, this is the strength of Collins's performance, is that she develops obviously this friendship, love affair with Kirk, but also in just two scenes, she develops a very warm connection with McCoy.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, again, it's good script writing, good direction, sure. But I mean, tremendous acting in such a tiny amount of screen time. Mm. You know, McCoy is brilliant in this thing where he's coming down from his quadrazine, and that homeless guy who ends up disintegrating himself with the phaser,
which
I think we know who that guy is in Ellison's original teleplay.
Yeah.
We'll talk about him next time. To going into the mission, getting the coffee, and then just, you know, the whole scene where he's sort of not sure if he's demented or...
The most common question to ask would be, where am I? I don't think I'll ask it.
Why not?
The only possible answer would conclusively prove that I'm either unconscious or demented.
It's three scenes in total, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they develop in that very short space of time a real connection there and a real warmth, which then adds to the tragedy of the...
Yeah.
Because when McCoy goes to save Edith Keeler, he's not just saving a complete stranger.
No.
He's saving someone who he, in his mind, has saved his life. He's returning, he's about to return a favour. He's about to pay off a debt. Because he says, you may have saved my life. And this is, he's then presented with an opportunity to do precisely, to pay off that debt.
That's why I like...
And Kirk stops him.
Spocks him sounds good.
And Spocks him. Yeah, we'll have to remember that one. To be spocked.
But I think that
this Graham has just made a familiar hand gesture, but in such a manner of context, which I'm never going to be able to unsee or unthink.
But yeah, you were going back to that, the way you've just built up the...
sorry, this
but it amplifies, in, well, it amplifies the tragedy more so in this story by having the reaction and the relationship with McCoy to Edith Keeler.
Yeah.
The way he reacts to his captain and his friend.
Yeah.
And there's that thing. And you can think that after that's finished, this episode's finished, you could see for days, weeks, McCoy is going to be so pissed off.
I reckon, exactly. If this was a part of a modern TV show, it would be part of a story arc, and Kirk and McCoy wouldn't be speaking to each other for weeks.
If this was a modern TV show, this episode would be an entire series.
Because
it is that important, and really, this is what we're going to talk about next episode, because this is the major problem with Ellison's original script, because it predicts story arcs within.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to close things off in a minute, and then
can we talk about the ending?
There's a couple of things I wanted to ask you, but let's talk about the ending. Graham, talk about the ending.
Well, the ending is just superb, and that makes the episode.
Yeah, you mean Edith Keeler's?
No, I mean the actual final line.
The final line. Let's get the hell out of here.
Yeah. It is just such a powerful line and so well done.
Yeah.
With everyone just standing there and ready to beam up again. It is.
The way that whole thing coalesces. Yeah. Because, and this is the thing, going back to story arcs.
Yeah.
Star Trek is an anthology show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a show that is understood implicitly by its producers.
Yeah.
But this is so everything goes back
to how it was. Yeah.
So you've got this sequence where they come back through the Guardian. They've only been away for a few seconds. So as far as everyone else is concerned, it's like nothing happened.
Mm.
And then you've got, and it's beautiful lighting, by the way, great direction. And then, you know, McCoy and Kirk just standing there, motionless and silent, separate, two different scenes, not standing together. And only Spock is able to actually confirm, you know, we were successful. And even he... You know, is you know, overcome by the emotion, the tragedy, and the fury, and just the everything, the awfulness of the whole thing.
Mm.
And then Kirk says, "Yes, let's get the hell out of here," which we understand is something that the networks had to fight hard.
Yeah.
The Roddenberry or the producers had to fight hard to from the networks to keep that line in there because.
Yeah.
It was so, when really, I mean, in modern days, it would be much stronger, wouldn't it? That kind of language, but strong language for the time on television. And the thing that strikes me is, again, when he says that, he says, let's get the hell out of here. And he's standing there, motionless. And all the crew all form up behind him for transport.
Mm.
And that's the thing that strikes me, is how he is motionless.
Yeah.
And they all just get into line and take these unconscious positions.
Yeah. Literally get into line.
Yeah, get into line behind him, ready, beam up off to the next mission. So you've got the weight of this awfulness but you've also got this acceptance that we are now moving on to the next gig and moving on to the next episode.
Mm.
And that, I mean, that, which is just Star Trek. That's mm-hmm. TOS yeah. in an absolute nutshell.
Mm.
And I agree with you. It's so pleasing because you get genuine closure from the episode.
Mm.
You do find yourself wondering about conversations. You wonder what would have happened if there'd been an epilogue. And at that stage in Star Trek, we used to have epilogues a lot.
Yeah.
They put so much in this episode. There's no time for an epilogue,
mm.
which is in a way is a shame. But I think in this instance,
oh, well, it's really totally
works. Yeah, yes, it does.
Quick question, then, if I may, Edith Keeler, an isolationist,
mm.
a Nazi sympathizer?
No, I don't think so.
No.
No.
So she becomes a...
I thought she was more of a peace activist.
Yeah, peace activist. Or do you think that she finds herself on the wrong...
I think it's probably more...
Do you think history would look upon Edith Keeler if she was real? Well, there are real people because she's based on a real person, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she would be put in with most other appeasers. If the war went as the story goes.
Yeah.
And it was a direct result of... the US not interfering.
Not intervening in
the Nazi arms build-up.
I mean, well, the thing is there was always questions. We're only 30-odd years after the war.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, five, ten years before the war, there was a big movement in America where there sort of be politicians who were still alive and people who were still alive who did not want anything to do with the war.
Yeah, and so they would have been her... I mean, they would have probably, for Edith Keeler... for her movement to gain traction into mainstream to the point where she actually meets FDR, she would have had powerful interests behind her. Sooner or later, she would have done. And probably, in fairness, you know, people with their own agendas.
But there was...
She might have found herself on the wrong side of history in many different ways.
I mean, during that 30s, there was lots of movements going on in America, but there was also a lot of popular culture. There was a very famous radio show that sort of had one of these... reverends who was going on during the 30s, during the sort of the Depression era, the sort of like, which would sound very similar to what we're getting in America now.
I can't
remember the actual sort of thing, but yeah, very sort of appeaser, but also sort of very going about how America should be great, blah blah blah, all this sort of stuff, but also blaming the sort of the outside conspiracies that have gone.
It's a harsh message though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Appeasers. I mean, it's probably not the intended message. Oh, appeasers must die. But I mean, for somebody like that to have to die because they believe in peace and have very pure motives.
So you're saying that's the message that comes out of this?
I think the message is that that America was right to go into the war. Mm-hmm. That's if there's a central political message that's there, and I think that's why Ellison might have one of his many beefs with it. Is I don't think that was Ellison's. Necessarily Ellison's message. But I mean, I think that is a message. It's a vindication of America's involvement in the Second World War.
Mm.
I suspect.
Yeah.
But that's small beer. It's central themes are, you know, roads less not travelled, and just how what are you prepared to do for love as well?
Mm.
What are you prepared to sacrifice? Ultimately, Kirk makes a decision to. Watch this woman he loves die in order to save everybody else. And I wonder to what extent this is something that others would do. Was it, you know, is that actually realistic? If you loved somebody to the extent...
I'd say probably not.
I wonder how realistic that is.
Mm.
And these are things that are explored in alternative versions of this episode, mm-hmm. which we're going to explore ourselves... in our next podcast, which we're going to do in a few minutes' time, but you won't get to listen to, unfortunately, for another couple of weeks, if not longer, the way that I'm going.
Unless you stack this up and you choose to listen to them both together.
Yeah,
then you can listen to it quicker than we can actually start recording.
That's true.
Yeah. Or if you've won the time game.
Oh, you have, yes.
Or if you have handy access to your own Guardian as well.
That's true. You could actually text us right now. And like scare us and tell us exactly what we're going
to I know what about. You're going to say next.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got flight safe mode on my phone, so I'm not going to get any texts.
They'll just jump through a big swirly mist.
That would be awesome. Yeah. That would be amazing. Is there anything else about this that you think that we've omitted that we have to ask to be said?
Oh, there is one thing. I have to apologise.
Didn't bring the photo novel.
I didn't bring the photo
novel. No, it's a colossal schoolboy error. We do have a comic book adaptation here, which we'll have to just do as a surrogate photo novel. So we'll end it there. Thanks very much for listening. Until the next episode of Impulse Destroy, from myself, Joe DeFern, and from Graham Sibley, and Derek Mitchell, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Let's get the hell out of here.